I'm in Newcastle. Most of my recording gear is at the theatre. So I am quietly sitting in my room, trying to figure out how to begin the podcast. How to begin the podcast. And so I figured I'd resolve. To just playing straight to my laptop. Sorry, I don't have more. Sorry, I don't have more to give. But on with the podcast. On with the podcast. It's a bit of a long cast this week, but on with the podcast.
You are listening to Bite Size Bryce with me, Bryce Halliday. Thank you for joining me. This week I am up at the Newcastle Fringe. Apparently this is the first year there's ever been one, and I signed up to do Sound Human up there, and I'm going to be there from Tuesday till Saturday doing Sound Human at the Royal Exchange. So if you are somehow listening to this in the next couple of days and you have friends in Newcastle, for the love of God, please send them. It's selling all right, but it would be nice to have a few more people to perform to. I've just come off of an awesome weekend of doing a thing called Global Game Jam, which was held at the North Sydney Institute in St. Leonard's, and it is a great weekend where a bunch of nerds all do a lock-in for a weekend, and on Friday evening everybody pitches an idea for a game. Most of them were video games, but people could do board games as well, and they have the weekend to make it. I've done things like this in the past. I've done a weekend called Kino Cabaret, which is a similar idea except with 5-minute films. So people come along and they pitch what their simple little idea for a film is, and likewise they just have the weekend to make it, and then there's a screening on Sunday night. Well, this was same thing with games, and I had such a great time meeting all these wonderful artists and designers and programmers and a lot of people that I wouldn't normally get a chance to meet. Although there was also a lot of acquaintances too through my involvement in the video game particulars last year, and there were a couple of familiar faces. And I wrote the music for two games. One of them was interesting. It was a virtual reality meditation game, which is played on Oculus Rift. So you sort of put the headset on, and then you can look around, and I was asked to make some very serene, calming music, so you could just sort of sit in this serene place with the headset on and meditate. And then I also wrote the music for a game called Almighty Hobba Gooba, which was a very fun game where the theme for the weekend was ritual. So the guys whose team I was on for that game had an idea for a sort of a generic high priest chieftain kind of character who's leading a ritual. It sort of ended up being a kind of a rain dance. And then he's surrounded by about 12 AIs who are all doing the same movements as him, but like a beat afterwards. So you could play as the chieftain leading the ritual, or you could play as three of the sort of 12 or so AIs that were around him. And those spots would be randomly picked on every game. And basically it was the job of the three imposters to try and mess up the ritual as much as they possibly could. And the priest has a very limited scope of vision, so he can move around the board. And if you sort of were clever in your messing up, you could suddenly start doing what all the AIs are doing while they're doing it so that you don't stand out. And then when he moves away from you again, you could dance around and start messing things up. And it was super fun, and I got to use a whole lot of samples of world instruments that I'd collected over the last little while to make a kind of generic mishmash of every sort of traditional religious music that I could think of. And I've been really blown away just over the last day or so. Lots of people have gotten in touch saying that they played the game and really enjoyed the music in it. So that was very, very unexpected to be part of such a cool, simple project. Sitting in front of me and very patiently just waiting there. I wasn't expecting to talk that long just to you guys. Sitting in front of me
You got in a rhythm, Bryce.
I did. I got on a roll. Is a photographer, a podcaster, and I know him through Impro. It is Lucas Brown. Thanks, Lucas, for joining me.
No problem, Bryce. And I need to point out that Newcastle Fringe does sound like something you'd wear on a jacket to a festival rather than an actual festival.
Yes. I have my. I was packing my bags this afternoon, and I realized, oh, I must grab my Sydney Festival shirt and my game jam shirt that they gave me yesterday. I was like, I'm throwing all these in.
Hey, merch isn't just for fun. It's can be surprisingly practical.
Yes. Can be a statement of, I have experience in other festivals.
Look at all these places I've been. Wouldn't you like me to be in your places? Give me a t-shirt.
Absolutely.
Maybe we'll see.
So how do we know each other?
Originally, when I was kind of getting reestablished with doing improv again, you see, I say the V. Does that make me weird?
No, that's fine. Yeah, yeah. I know a lot of people have very strong views on this, whether it's impro or whether it's improv. I happen to have worked with a company called Impro Australia for a long time, but I'm not zealous about it.
Yeah, so basically what I had come out of some of the classes, and at one of the grad nights that I was in, they had suggested everyone come along to a certain jam, and through that jam I met Natalie, who runs the very studio that we're in.
Yes.
And we're very thankful for that. Thanks, Nat. and through that, I then started to do what was then called Fresh, which Jim...
Yes.
We're doing at the now defunct Roxbury Hotel.
Yes.
And through that, I suppose then just kind of bouncing into each other at various other events.
Yeah.
I did other shows at that place. I did Swarm.
Well, you're a bit like me where you tend to just kind of show up at things, but often in your capacity as a photographer, so it kind of makes sense. But I've had a lot of very disparate events that... In fact, there's been you who have run into have gone, oh, of course, you're here.
Exactly. And also, the thing is with improv is that you tend to meet all kinds of people, and all kinds of those people have other interests. Like, through your game jam mention, I remembered that I met Paul Stager, who was a game designer who I've been to a few of his launches. And frankly, improv is a fantastic networking tool where you get to meet all kinds of interesting people. And as a photographer, I did a running portrait series over 6 weekends where I would just pack in as many sort of portraits impromptu as I could. And I would set up maybe 5 or 6 in a day and just like walk from one to the next. Mm. And you were actually one of those.
Oh, of course.
I went over to your house. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the idea of that was that you were getting creative people in the space when they're working? Was that the point?
Well, essentially, it was whatever I could get away with. I mean, and at certain points, I was doing people I had met through Twitter. I was doing people I had met through improv. I was essentially finding people wherever they were to be found. Some people met me, like, out in the wild. I did some shots at Sydney Uni. I did some shots at sort of the park down by Broadway. Mm. Some of them in Camperdown Rest Park in Newtown, which is a great spot because it has that fantastic wall that you can shoot against. And with you, it was just you were the first of the day and you were at your house. And
yeah.
So I then got a little tour of, at the time, Bryce's home studio.
Yeah, that's before I moved all my stuff in here.
Yeah, yeah, before you moved into the cave, the Bryce cave. And yeah, it was great. You got to show off your various keyboards and mixers and things.
Mm. I'm pretty sure it's still one of the quite wide-angled shots that you took is still my cover photo on.
Oh, great!
On Twitter, somebody gave it the caption up because I'm just sitting in a chair, just kind of looking up at a bunch of sheet music. And I think you've just caught me where I've just kind of breathed out, and so someone's captioned it as just now what, which is quite good. Nice.
But yeah, the whole fun of that was that it was a bit of a challenge. I was shooting everything on film.
Yeah.
I had 3 or 4 different, extremely different cameras with me at the time. I was shooting Saturday and Sunday, dropping the film off on Monday, picking it up on Tuesday if I could, writing about each day on Wednesday and Thursday, planning the next shoot on Friday, and then shooting Saturday, Sunday, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. I did that for a 6-week period. And
yeah.
It was exhausting but incredibly rewarding because I had this huge body of work at the end of it. Mm. That was very little of it was planned, and I could say I had a grand overarching theme that I was going to improvise whatever I went into the thing. But really, I didn't. It was one of those good improvisings in that I didn't actually think about it.
Yeah,
I just
yeah.
kind of did it as it landed. There was no overarching.
Yeah, it's that kind of beautiful thing of when you do it for a little bit, and as you say, as it's landing, you can then look back on it and go, oh, this does kind of cohesively tie together as a thing, even though it didn't feel like it at the time.
Yeah, totally.
So I mean, with that project, you were shooting a lot on film. Is that is that a focus of your photography work more generally than that, or was that just for that particular project that wanted to play around with?
No, I do tend to shoot on film primarily, not for any kind of aesthetic reason, although I do like it. I like the aesthetics of film. I think it has a warmer look. It tends to be, you can isolate people better and really focus on what you want to, and also it forces you to think creatively, and but also in that same way that makes you take your time. So these are all good things that I really like. Like I recently bought a Chinese copy of a Rolleiflex camera called a Seagull, which was made in the 1950s, and there's nothing electronic to it. It's entirely clockwork and gears.
Wow.
And it's got some of the most beautiful glass I've ever shot through. Mm. And it's it's got no neck strap, so I can't be cavalier with it. I have to hold onto it like the death grip and also hold it at waist level and look down through it and focus just right because and sometimes I take a light reading, sometimes I don't. It's just a matter of I have to sit and think and focus and hold very still and actually like crank something to wind up the shutter and then release it, and that's it. And it's like that process to me is a different feeling than shooting with a digital camera. And I'm not a snob. I don't go, oh, you know, I never shoot with digital. No, I have a couple of very nice digital cameras that I like shooting with. If someone says I want headshots, I'll probably bring a digital camera. But I mean, I have now upwards of 50 analog cameras. Until recently, all of them shot. A few of them have been dying over the years. Because, you know, you have these hand machine parts and one tiny gear breaks in the inside of a camera.
Yeah, and there's no way to get a spare. Yeah,
you go to take it into a shop and they go, well, if you can get an identical camera and rip it apart and take out one gear and then pay someone $200 to fix it on this camera you paid $40 at a flea market for.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not really worth it. But no, it's something that I really enjoy.
Mm. It's definitely something we said for that process of just how much more concentration, I guess, the task of setting up the shot and going, okay, now I need to nail this because I've only got so many shots.
Yeah, I mean, if you're shooting with 120, you've got 12 images, and that's it on a roll the size of battery.
My dad's a big Shackleton nut. Like, he just loves the life of Shackleton and what he achieved going to the South Pole. And there was an exhibition about him at the Sydney Maritime Museum, so we went to that. And there was a whole lot of photography. I wish I could remember the name of the photographer who was with him, but there was a specific guy on the trek whose sole job it was to do photography. And there were these amazing shots. And the exhibition was mostly this photography. But it was getting towards the end of the exhibit that it suddenly dawned on me, oh my gosh, he got all these shots and he would have had no idea what they would look like for like 8 months after he shot some of these because they got lost on the expedition.
Oh, jeez. And also, I mean, they'd be using a big box camera on a giant wooden tripod that would weigh as much as me. Mm. And these were shots that had to be held for minutes at a time in some cases. It's just why no one smiles in old photos, because no one can hold a smile for more than about 30 seconds without feeling like a tip.
I wondered about that.
Exactly. That's why in all those old photos, everyone has a stern face, because they're trying their best to hold still and not fidget.
Yeah.
And I remember going to an exhibit in Germany of these very old tintype, and I can't actually say it. It's like aluminotype or something. Mm. It's a very, very early form of shooting on metal.
Yeah.
And it was one of those very old poses where it was a man standing and holding his hat under his arm, and there was a street behind him, and the street looked empty. And I'm thinking, of course it did. The horses have all moved. Mm. But in the corner of this image was a blur, which the little description on the side said, that was a kid playing with a ball. He stayed in the same place, but was moving the whole time to enough to give a view. So it's like there's this perfectly still person, and then this black globe of a blur next to him. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah. So there wasn't any ghost of the horses passing by?
No, because think about it. If it's open for 30 seconds and a horse is in there for maybe 1 second, that's 29 other seconds where there's nothing there. And that will override that. Mm. Especially if the horse is a dark shape. I mean, you get no reflection off of like the tackle and stuff. There's nothing to fill that spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And speaking of that, the other thing I really like about film is the ability for experimentation. I do a lot of stuff with random double exposures and overlapping and film swaps with people overseas.
What does that mean?
When you're film swaps?
Film swapping with someone?
Well, basically what it means is that you take a roll of film. Let's say it's a 400 ISO roll of film, like the kind you get from what used to be a grocery store or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you would shoot it at 800 ISO. So you shoot it at half strength. Right. So you would go and I'd shoot, you know, all over Sydney, whatever I wanted to see. And I would try to avoid things with bright lights, and I would look for things with dark shadows. And so I take it at half power, essentially. So it only needs half as much light as it actually does. I would then send it to my friend Annika in the States, or I would send it to my other friend D in the States, or I would send it to someone in Scandinavia or Europe or somewhere. Mm. And what they would do is they would reload that back into their camera, also shoot on half strength, and then go shoot their city. And one or both of us would then develop the film, depending on who sent it first. And what you get, especially if you mark the beginning so there's no real overlap, is you get these superimposed shots where it's half them and half you. Yeah. And you have no idea how it's going to work because you haven't discussed it with them. You don't know where they are, don't know what they're shooting it on. You can even change it so that I'm shooting on a panoramic camera, which takes up two spots, and you have two individual overlaps within that one shot. And this is where it gets a little bit up its own butt here, but analog is such a it's such a simple process where it's like, okay, wherever light will fall on a picture is where that picture will be. If you block half of that, like say with a little gadget called a splitzer or even a piece of tape or something, and you cover half your lens, there will be half black in that spot. So when you reshoot it, that will take as a full image, whereas the other will be muddled and crossed over. You can even do it with some cameras where you can block half, you know, recock the shutter, flip it over, and then shoot the other half. And you can mix these together. I've done splits of between 4 and 12 different pie shapes that slightly overlap at the edges. And I can do it in the course of a day, take one frame.
Right.
And get a little corner, like a little piece of the pie as you go.
Yeah.
And get something at the end that I had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that.
Add to that that you don't know what it'll be for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days after you drop it off at the lab. Or in my case, I've got a huge fishbowl at my house full of to develop stuff. I'll throw it in the bottom. Maybe 4 months later, I'll pull it out and I'll go, oh, right, that was that day I went down to the fish market.
So how many things do you come across that are like, okay, as opposed to things that are like, oh, wow, this kind of...
Well, that's the thing is that there's usually at least something interesting in most of it. However, I can tell, like, there is like a pattern that develops. Let's say if I'm bored in my job at the time, where I try to enforce it. I get too intense. I will be constantly going for walks on my lunch break, taking photos of the same stuff, trying to make it interesting.
So is this what you're passionate about? Is this
absolutely? Like, and it's something where, you know, I got into it completely by accident, where I'm old enough to have shot with film when I was a kid and when I was a teenager. And
you just brought back a memory for me of my dad had an SLR camera. I think he showed me how to shoot with it on like a roll of film. And then there was just like a summer that I spent shooting with this camera with no film in it whatsoever, just like setting up shots. And then because it had, what's the name of that, the sort of crosshair in the middle that sort of changes color based on how much light there is.
I'm not sure what you mean.
You're looking through the viewfinder.
Yeah.
And then in the very center of
the reticle in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. But on this one at least, I think it was based on how bright certain parts of the image were. I think it had mercury in it or something.
Yeah, like a little light meter, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So I would set up shots like that using this sort of light meter, but it was just an empty camera. And I was just shooting all this stuff, but taking it very, very seriously. You know?
Yeah, see, I used to play with cameras like that when I was little because I loved that of winding on. It felt cool because I would see spy movies where they'd be taking tons and tons of photos and winding on really fast, and I loved that sound. But where it got interesting for me was that my dad was working and he had a camera for his work. And what he would do is he would send me one roll of film of the film he had been allotted. He was working in a different part of the country at the time. And he would say, look, go and shoot that with your friends. I'll develop it when I develop my work stuff. And then I'll give you the photos.
Right. And, what did your dad do?
Oh, dad worked for the police.
Right.
And so was off on business a lot of times, and stuff I can't really talk about.
Yep.
But but basically, like, where he realized I was a little bit more is I remember getting a phone call and he'd be like, "Are you taking pictures of trees?" And I got real defensive, like, "No, like I've been caught with porn under my bed, I swear." And yeah, it was me experimenting and saying, "All right, well, that's a great image, and I'll take that thing on this terrible little camera." And really, like, that's part of the reason why I'm not really a gearhead. Where you know, I'll talk to people and they'll have fancy full frame cameras, 36 megapixels, and cost them $4,000. And for the first maybe 10 years I was in Sydney, the only camera I had a whopping 2.5 megapixels. It weighed 1.5 kilos, took 4 AA batteries, and it took pictures.
What brand was that?
Oh, it was an Olympus. It was a C250L, and sorry, 2500L. And yeah, it weighed 1.5 kilos, and it took pictures that were 800 by 600 wide. So it's something that you couldn't even put on a desktop now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, my first mobile phone in Australia had more megapixels than that camera, but it had really good glass, and it also meant I could just wander around and take as many as I wanted and get better. So there was this idea that, okay, well, these are these film cameras, and I really love them. And then I got a digital, and being a kid that had no money, I was like, this is great. I can take as many photos as I want and never have to go and develop it. But then I left a terrible job as a debt collector for a debt collection agency in Parramatta, which was a 2-hour train trip to and from. And I hated that job. And so what I did is as I left this job that I hated, my team, who liked me fine, didn't realize because I clearly kept all my hatred inside, bought me a gift certificate as a farewell. And it's like this one of those little Westfield debit cards. And I went to, like, I had like a week before I started my other job, so I would go on these big long walks through the city. And I went to the Museum of Contemporary Art. And in the gift shop, they have all these Lomography cameras. And Lomography is an Austrian movement of sort of freestyle film photography. It's all don't think, just shoot.
Right.
And, you know, taking chances and, you know, just having fun with it. And their site
is... Are they digital or...?
No, completely film-based.
Right.
They were based originally off of...
So how many frames can you get on a roll with them?
36.
Right.
Or 24, depending on how long it is.
Right.
But basically, it's they have a whole series of these weird and wacky cameras, some they found in China. They started with one they found in Austria that was a little Russian automatic camera that also had the best slightly radioactive glass that you'll find. Yeah, the old ones are not actually allowed to travel because they are all slightly... They click those Geiger counters a little bit.
Right. Hey, why? Where were they manufactured?
Leningrad.
Right.
And that'll do it. But no, it's like I used that gift card. I bought a Diana Mini, which is one of the simplest little cheap plastic stamped cameras you can use, and just started shooting. And Diana Minis are great because you can shoot half frame, which means you get 72 portrait pictures instead of 36 of that, which is great when you're learning again and remembering that, you know, you have to hold your hands real steady.
Yeah.
And there's one tiny little lever that you pull. And but then because you have nothing to lose, it's just like, whatever, I've got 72 to get through. I'll see how this works. I'll see how that works. And from that job, that was maybe 5 years ago, I've now fallen completely down the rabbit hole where I shoot maybe five times as much film as I do digital.
Why does a digital SLR make a shutter noise?
It's because it's still the aperture is still closing.
Right.
And I think part of it is like a skeuomorphic thing where it's like they have to make it sound like a camera.
Yeah, yeah. Because I remember just like, whenever you hear like a news report, and you go, well, that's all the real shutter sound, but my iPhone just makes a shutter sound.
Yeah.
There's actually when you take a photo.
There's a really cool, I think it's on one of the early 99% Invisibles,
which is
a fantastic podcast, where they talk about the guy who developed the sounds that go with the first touch screen on the iPhone and how you design for... To give a reaction when there is no input to your fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
And how that click for unlocking an iPhone took them ages to develop, where it's like, it has to sound like something is opening.
Yeah.
And it has to sound like physical. It has to be a click. One of those things where reality is unrealistic. And I spent a while being very interested in Foley and sound engineering. And a long time where, in my first year in Australia, I used to watch the extended edition Lord of the Rings featurettes because you could hit play all, and that's 6 hours of content.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're at home just, you know, making breakfast, have it on in the background. It's quiet Kiwi people talking about how they designed this with a bit of a lion's roar and this with a walrus and the edge of a balloon being rubbed against a microphone.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mix that together and you get a horrifying beast noise.
Yeah, no, I love that, all that kind of stuff too. I mean, as you've seen, the last kind of third of my show is all sort of Foley that starts as a bit of a joke and then becomes this whole kind of world that's trying to surround you.
Yeah, it's great.
So what else was your interest in sound?
Oh, well, sound, I think, was just something that I came to. And the thing is, this is only something that makes sense to me in hindsight. I actually have a weird sensitivity to sound that relates to focus. And it's not really something I've ever been diagnosed with, although I did have a thing, you know, in school you do the hearing tests.
Yeah, yeah.
I scored lower than I should have, and they were worried that I had some kind of hearing disorder, because when lots of stuff is going on, I can't focus, and sound is the number one way that distracts me.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I'm in a crowded shopping center where, you know, I'm cheek to jowl with everybody else, and you ask me to look at a menu and make a decision, I can't read it. I can't focus on it. I start to jitter and blink out, and I become a terror to be around. So I think, it never actually occurred to me until much later that I would look at it and I would go, all right, I love old radio shows, and I love documentaries about how they built the Jurassic Park Tyrannosaurus roar.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of Foley stuff, and being like, okay, that doesn't sound right, but that sounds right. Why does that sound right? So,
yeah.
You know, the Indiana Jones punch is a baseball bat against a pile of leather jackets. But in your head, that's a punch when it goes thwack, and it's just perfect. But, you know, actually, it was something that struck me. I was rewatching The Wire with my girlfriend. It's maybe the fourth time for me, the first time for her. Hmm. And at one point, I think it's in season four, Michael grabs a kid and just starts smacking the crap out of him. Hmm. Because he's, you know, tried to steal from him or something. And he holds him by the collar and he's hitting him with a closed fist just back and forth like he's smacking him. Mm. And the sound is so small that I thought maybe the DVD had turned off.
Yeah.
But then you realize, no, if you're really hitting someone,
that's what it sounds like.
That's what it sounds like. He's not trying to make a noise.
Yeah.
He's just hitting him really hard. And it's like, oh, yeah.
Mm. As over this weekend, we were kind of down to the final hours of having to get this video game together.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized that we didn't have any sounds. If the high priest chieftain guy catches the people in his tribe who are not AIs but are real people, if he catches them, they will click on them and they'll basically be smited.
They're smoted.
They will explode. And we realized we had no sounds for that. So I like quickly sort of ran off into a room and just... I overlaid sounds of me just going like with voices of me going aw and like and like oh stuff. But then I was like, wait, it's also possible to mistakenly kill the AI, and then that is your point. I was like, I gotta think of something different for that. And so in my haste I was like, what if the AI are just really offended that this happened? So they still get the exploding noise, but they're like, hey. I'm like, aw. And so I just sort of came back 10 minutes later with like, here's about 20 sounds of me sort of making exploding noises with voices over the top. Put these in the game if you like. So tell me about all your podcasts, please. Geez. Please.
Well, way back when I used to do a podcast called The Culture Squad with my friends Jen Doherty, Dan Binns, and Joel Turner, and we just basically would get together and talk over. It would always be a couple of texts. It would always be, you know, a film and an album. Or a comic book and a TV show. And it was just sort of this roundtable thing, and it was really nice. The only problem was that's four people with four different jobs, all with four different schedules, and all trying to find the time to see a thing or read a thing, which is why we stopped doing books after a while, because the idea of, hey, this 350-page book, you need to get through it in 2 weeks so we can record again.
Yeah, yeah.
Despite, again, some of us working nights, some of us working days, some people having extracurricular stuff, Dan running around on location shoots because he's a filmmaker. So it was just this very different thing. But since then, like even towards the end of that, I lived a lot closer to Joel than the others, and I started to come in to do little extra things. These little interstitial short episodes where I would take a text we'd already done and recommend six other things with similar themes. Or I would get Dan in a room and we would like deep dive over a film, or get Joel to sit down and I would bring over a bunch of comic books and we would talk about the making of layouts of comic books and the amazing things that like Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey do, or J.H. Williams III, or Mike Allred when it comes to the actual art of comic books. And that was really fascinating, and it was really sad when eventually we called it on that podcast, and it's been maybe 2 years, and I finally, I've finally convinced someone to follow through on one of my crazy ideas, because I really love a series called Avatar The Last Airbender, which then became The Legend of Korra. Legend of Korra is much more famous because it famously has a queer protagonist and a ton of strong female characters, although I hate that expression.
Yeah,
it's just tons of different kinds of women, all of whom are celebrated. It's amazing.
We should just start with going, has tons of actual female characters.
Actual and varied, not particular type, and none of them is shown to be, oh, this is the right one to do.
Yeah,
they're all
yeah.
people. And it's also, again, a very deep story, and I think it's one of my favorite works of fiction, that work from beginning to end.
And so that is... It is an anime series, right?
Yeah, it was originally on Nickelodeon, was Avatar The Last Airbender for 3 seasons, and then Korra got 4 seasons and got completely screwed over to the 4th season was just online.
Because I don't know much about it, I wasn't sure if it was originally a comic or something, and then became a series.
They've since done a comic series that bridges the gap between the two, and it's fantastic as well.
Right.
But it's basically magic kung fu.
Yeah.
It's elemental magic kung fu in this incredible...
I do remember watching it a little bit when I was younger.
Oh, it's my favorite thing. I can and will talk about it for ages. And as such, Joel said, look, I don't think we could ever do it on the podcast in a round table because you'd talk the whole time.
Yeah.
And he's like, and I say that because I'm your friend and I can tell you this. So finally what had happened is that I've been listening to lots and lots of a podcast called Sailor Business. And what that does, that's Chris Sims and Jordan D. White, who are comic book writers who watch every episode of the 1992 Sailor Moon anime. One episode per episode, and they take a 22-minute episode and they talk about it for maybe an hour and 20 minutes.
Wow. Like
they go deep. And it's not even that they just go, oh, well, this is what I thought of it. It's they go through scene by scene and what that scene means.
Yeah.
It's what they recommended, a podcast from there called Go Bayside, which was April Richardson, who is a comedian in LA, who used to get her friends to come over, watch an episode of Saved by the Bell, and critically break it down. And from that, anyway, coming back to the point, from that, I was like, look, what TV show talks to me in that way that I could talk about as much as I wanted? And only needs basically me and one other person. And, hey, my girlfriend really loves Avatar The Last Airbender, and I probably wouldn't be able to convince her to watch all of Justice League. Hmm. So, and I pitched it to her. I'm like, yeah, why don't we do this? This would be great. And her response was, oh, I wouldn't know what to say. I'm like, we've had these conversations. We had this conversation on our first date, which is actually brought up in the first episode, where I say...
Which is why we're still together at all.
Yes. On Valentine's Day, we gave each other volumes 1 and 2. Of the Avatar The Last Airbender comic series, where she gave me volume 2 and I gave her volume 1 without us talking to one another. So the show is called Crossroads of Destiny, named after one of the episodes. Here's the thing. Relationships are about compromise and give and take.
Yes.
So in order to get Kimiko to step up and excel the way she does at Avatar The Last Airbender podcasting, I may have made a rash decision. I committed to doing a similar podcast on the entirety of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. All of it.
Right.
And the spin-offs.
And how many series are there?
Well, you see, Bryce, if you talk about the main series, there are 11 seasons. 20
of how many episodes?
24 episodes each.
Wow.
And at about season 5, they switch from half an hour to an hour.
Wow.
And then...
Thoroughly kept up with.
Then there is Kim and Courtney Take New York, which has 3 seasons. There's Chloe and Lamar, which has 2 seasons. There's Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding. There's Chloe and Courtney Take the Hamptons, which has 3 seasons. Then there's going to be, there's I Am Kate, which follows Caitlyn Jenner. And then there is soon coming Cocktails with Courtney, both with K's. And yeah, I'm going to be doing this for the next 20 frickin' years.
So I'm still not... Why did this need to happen? Is this because it's Kimiko's
Because
thing?
Kimiko loves Keeping Up with the Kardashians. It is her favorite thing on the planet. And she loves them because she comes from, as she puts it, she comes from a family of monsters. Lovable monsters. Just people who occasionally say terrible things and do terrible things. And so she completely relates to it. I have since heard... in order to justify this in my head, I listened to a very good Stuff Mom Never Told You episode about how they are viewed and why people will think they are important in terms of feminism and this idea of, okay, well, this is their story. And one woman actually compared it to, okay, you've got the pretty but kind of vapid daughter who everyone dotes on. You've got the smarter one who's younger but not as pretty and therefore is not getting as much attention. You've got a few younger kids rolling around who are all a bit silly. You've got the grumpy father and you've got the helicopter mother. This is Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is called Dashcast with a K.
Right.
And so that is my other podcast. And we're doing them sort of concurrently. We're alternating. Mm. And so, yeah, I'm actually, for all that I talk a lot more on Crossroads of Destiny, I'm fulfilled by both of them.
That's gorgeous. Well, we might start to wrap this thing up.
Sure.
So, so far, I've had 2 pitches for what the format of a bite-sized Bryce should be. Do you have any ideas for how I should progress with my season?
Well, I still say that you should stick with, because you said bite-sized Bryce, and I immediately thought of Teeny Little Super Guy from Sesame Street. So I think you should plaster yourself on the glass.
So refresh our memories on Teeny Little Super Guy?
Teeny Little Super Guy was one of the rare live-action Sesame Street interstitial cartoons, where normally you'd get, oh, we're cutting away to that little typewriter that goes, and then types on him. yeah. On his buttons, or you'd get the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11,
12. Yeah, yeah. See, that's in yeah. there.
Oh, God, and it was somebody did that. I think it was the Pointer Sisters or someone like that, someone incredibly famous did that, and then were uncredited forever. But what Teeny Little Super Guy was is that you got this like little plastic cup like you'd get at a festival for beer.
Yeah.
And on this was drawn a little like chubby cartoon guy with a little fedora who would sing a little song about how he was a teeny little super guy and do a little tap dance, and you hear the as he snap his fingers or whatever, and he had this voice kind of like this. Yeah. Snap your fingers, here I come.
Yeah.
And it's
The
actual episodes would be him going around the kitchen talking to other characters that lived in silverware or glasses and helping them out with their problems.
So the other talks to other cartoon characters or just other items of items?
Well, because I think the other glasses would have other characters on it. Otherwise, it would just be like a pair of tongs that would be kind of talking like a duck.
Yeah.
And his superpower, which is why he was a super guy, which only occurs to me as an adult, is that he could, like, go under the counter and between shelves, which they would do by slowly cutting down the plastic cup so that it was sliding under and sliding away.
Mm.
And I basically went, this is Kitty Pryde from X-Men. As a tiny, gruff cartoon man. It makes no sense to me then, and it makes no sense to me now. Like, I will watch Grover be a waiter till the cows come home. Yeah. I will watch Super Grover run into a tree a million times. You could not pay me to watch the entirety of Teeny Little Super Guy.
Teeny Little Super Guy.
Yeah, and it's the worst earworm, too. Yeah. I will guarantee you, I will be humming it all the way home. Hoops has nothing on Teeny Little Super Guy.
So basically, I have to not only become two-dimensional, but also become a man-sized plastic cup. And
then go take on this.
What was the voice?
Yeah. Do you remember the time?
Yeah, yeah.
Did I ever tell you about the time?
Yeah.
It's a little bit flat in your voice, and then you sort of squash it. So it's when it goes back like this, I know.
And so, yeah, as we wrap up, you would be by far the most versed in this, having done several podcasts about this. But yeah, what's one or two pieces of culture that you've been absorbing kind of recently? Not necessarily this very week, but I guess I'm interested in stuff that you kind of are still absorbing, so you're not really sure what the opinion is, but you're sort of enjoying it.
Something that I'm still absorbing. I know Transformers are a hot button topic. The reason they're a hot button topic is, I was explaining this to Megan of the Hard Times podcast and many other things, and what it is, it's that Transformers have always been a weird niche, because the people who like Transformers, they were the ones that the people who read comic books looked down on. So it's like, I know, I've been in comic book conversations, and I'll mention Transformers, and that, oh, you know, I know about the different toy runs and the various TV series, and I had 3 VHS tapes from when I was little that I would watch until I was in university. And you get those looks, the look that you're giving me right now, Bryce. And then the movies
I was just appreciating the face that you made when you said in university.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because it was those same 3 tapes, and they had the old commercials, and they had occasionally intermixed gem episodes.
I have, I presume they're still at my mum's place, there's like tapes that we recorded in the United Kingdom before we moved to Australia. And so there'll just be ads, and you go, oh, that's right. Ads sound different in the UK, of course.
Yeah. But basically, Transformers is my oldest fandom. And it was something that I couldn't talk about with people. And then the movies came out, and for a while, like 2 days, that was great because everyone was talking about Transformers. And this knowledge was good for something. And then the rest of those movies came out, and then I just wanted to shut up again. I never wanted to talk about it again. But what's happened recently, like in the past maybe 4 years, is there was a really good run on the Transformers series by IDW. And then they split it into 2 books. And one of those books is called More Than Meets the Eye. That's the book that I'm going to recommend. Because what it does is Transformers has a core concept across a dozen television series, across all the comics. There's Autobots and there's Decepticons. They're having a war.
Yeah.
They came from a planet called Cybertron, and they wrecked it by fighting too much. And then they came to Earth and continued fighting. That's it. That's your elevator pitch. And there's lots of them. Where More Than Meets the Eye starts is at the end of this big battle that has made it, like, honestly, a wasteland. There's no buildings left. Nothing is left. But it wins the war for the Autobots. And they go, that's great, we've won the war. Now what? Well, what happens is that all of the non-combatants that left the planet during this 6 million year war come back.
Right.
And there are more of them than there are Autobots and Decepticons. So think of it like if the military of the United States was fighting the military of Russia. And then the rest of the planet came back.
Yeah.
And said, okay, we're really sick of you guys fighting. Like, you've actually destroyed everything. We're going to take over. We're going to have a democratically elected government. And we kind of don't want you around because you're relics of a wartime that we left to forget.
Yeah.
And really, you're just going to cause trouble.
Yeah.
So it's like that's a really like meditative take on this really simple toyetic concept. And what they do is they take these characters who are usually one note. You know, I have one thing, it's that I'm reckless, or I have one thing, and that, oh, I'm a little bit thoughtful and intelligent. And they let them become characters because they remove them from the situation that they have been jammed into. And it's written by James Roberts and the art's by Alex Milne and Nick Roche. I've only gotten through the first volume, the first trade.
Right.
I intend to hunt down the rest of it and read it and become a complete bore about it, talking to people at parties.
Awesome. My bit of culture this week is I was recommended to check out a rap group called Clipping, which was recommended to me because the main guy in it is David Diggs, who plays Jefferson in Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, which is getting rather popular at the moment.
It's pretty great.
But yeah, this, so it's this voice that I recognize, but his background is in this really experimental hip-hop group where a lot of the music just has really harsh synthesizers behind it. And that's all I can really describe. And, like, nothing else. There's a lot of it. The music is very minimalist, even though the rap and lyrics are incredible. A lot of them, like, breakneck speed, where you go, oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's just fascinating to listen to rap being done over something stuff that is. Sometimes it's just sort of harsh sort of noise.
Okay.
Which is, yeah, awesome. Part of my steadily getting more and more into rap music. It's been a huge part of my life, but I'm also potentially starting to work on some my own kind of rap musical work with some other Sydney-based artists. I can tell you're
confident in this project by the fact that you trailed off so hard in that sentence. Is it challenging? Like, have you been finding challenging to kind of modify your style? Because you've got quite a melodic style to most of your...
Yeah,
it'll work, and it seems to be very kind of...
Well, we haven't gotten terribly deep into it. It's more and more at the stage of kind of figuring out the story, but I guess I'm trying to do my homework music-wise. It would be a pretty dramatic shift from the way that I think about song structures, because I guess this will be my other piece of culture to recommend. At the end of last year, I finished reading Stephen Sondheim's anthology of all his lyrics, which is in two books. It's called Finishing the Hat, is Volume 1. Which is sort of the first half of his career, and then the second volume is called Look, I Made a Hat, which comes from the lyrics of his song called Finishing the Hat. And it's basically, it's every lyric that he ever wrote, annotated all the way through, with just fascinating, sometimes it's thoughts on songwriting itself, sometimes it's what was happening in his life at the time, sometimes it's why was this creative decision made in this show, and there's lots and lots of material that was cut from shows, and there's lots of times when he goes, here's the original version of the song, and you can read through it and go, oh, I can see there's a chunk that survived from this to elsewhere.
Yeah, sort of a kernel of this has led to the growth of something else.
Yeah. But, I mean, the thing I really took away from his work is that there's so much care taken on every single word because you have so few of them. And that's not to say that I think rap music doesn't take care with the lyrics, because I know it's exactly the same word. They're taking a lot of care. But there are, at least in most rap music, there's a lot more words in it. So you can kind of, if I can smash two parts of our conversation together, perhaps this collides with the idea of shooting on film, where you've got only so many shots, so you've got to really take care with each.
Everything has to be perfectly placed.
And it's the same thing with a, you know, like a 32-line song. Every word has to really have something to it while still being musical. And so that sort of fascinated me coming from that approach. And then now doing a bit of homework on, okay, what's some rap music that I can really get behind and enjoy and not just be another white guy who really likes Hamilton?
See, I actually, in the last couple of years, have been expanding my rap knowledge as well, although I came at it purely through lyrics, in that I kind of like you may have noticed, I kind of fall down wiki holes and read a lot about stuff. And what happened is that, again, an influence of Kimiko's. Kimiko's a huge fan of the music of Kanye West. Mm. And it was something where, apart from Gold Digger, I'd never really listened to Kanye West. And all I knew was a lot of people didn't like him, and a lot of people really did like him. Mm. And people thought, well, you know, like him or not, he's trying stuff. Mm. And I tried to listen to a few things off Yeezus, and I was like, this is harsh and weird, like Metal Machine music kind of stuff. And what I did is I went back and I just started looking at the lyrics on Rap Genius. Hmm. And what they'll do is they'll go, okay, you'll notice here this internal rhyme will match with this internal rhyme.
Yeah.
And this choice of word will match with this other choice of word, creating a four-line theme using synonyms of this one word when he's talking about something else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, again, all that does actually tie in with the same approach that Sondheim talks about. There's just less words overall in the package, but in what Sondheim's doing, you have very clever rhyming schemes that within a verse there's a great rhyming structure, but and then there'll just be like a line in the middle there that doesn't rhyme with anything else in that verse because it rhymes with exactly the same line in the next verse and the next verse.
Yeah.
And it's stuff where you read back and you have it pointed out to you, and there's a moment where you go, why would he bother doing that? And you'll listen through the song again and go, oh, that, yeah, that, I don't know what it is, but that really glues the whole song together, that rhyme comes back on a subconscious level because it's relating to 30 seconds ago in the song rather than a moment ago. So, yeah, I don't think I'm game enough to write my own rap lyrics yet. I'm working with somebody else, but I'm with all that kind of homework. I'm hoping I can bring some of that into the lyrics that I do.
I think you can. I have faith in you, Bryce.
Thank you, Lucas. Shall we wrap it up then? If people want to find your stuff, your photography, your podcasts, how should they connect with you?
It's real simple. The main site for my portfolio is lokified.com, lokified.com. Same on Twitter, lokified. If you want to find Dashcast, it's dashkast.com or just Dashcast Show on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to find Crossroads of Destiny, it's crossroadsofdestiny.com. I could not believe that URL was available. Or you can look up Crossroads Show on Twitter. Or either are available on RSS or iTunes, and we'd love some more rate and subscribe because we're just starting off. And though we actually have some high profile guests coming up.
Awesome. And people can find me on Twitter. Mr. Bryce Halliday is my handle there. And Instagram is bryce.halliday. And yes, again, tomorrow I head to Newcastle to do Sound Human at the Fringe there. So if you know people in Newcastle, please send them along. Otherwise, in another month after that, I'll be down in Melbourne for the Melbourne Comedy Festival doing 3 weeks there. I'm so excited to do Melbourne again. Thanks again for joining me, Lucas.
No problem, Bryce.
You are listening to Bite Size Bryce.
That was the podcast. Did you learn a lot of coughs this week? I certainly did cast. Here on the podcast.